This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from BFM 89.9. I'm Meera Sivasudhi. Now, after 8 years on the air, we're bringing the Bigger Pictures Health and Living to you, live, on the ground. A whole day with the experts, debunking myths behind heart disease and diabetes, addressing our love affair with food. Of course, George will be there talking about sperm. So join us at BFM's Health and Living Live 2016 on Saturday, 2nd of April. Go on and register at bfm.my/health.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Good health, education, housing, and access to the basic needs of life are basic human rights which the poor are often deprived of. Last year, Sungai Siput Member of Parliament, Dr. Jayakumar Devaraj, surveyed 130 low-income Malay families in his constituency and discovered some uncomfortable facts and trends. He joins me now to discuss his findings and recommendations to address this issue of rural poverty in Malaysia. Welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
The World Bank just released a statement this week saying that Malaysia's poverty level has improved tremendously, with its extreme poverty rate reduced to 0.28% from among the highest in the world about four decades ago. What's your opinion on this?
Well, I think Malaysia has done quite well. If we compare Malaysia with countries in, say, Africa, for example, our per capita income is about six times higher than them. So I think we cannot keep on comparing ourselves with the poorest nations in the world. You know, we say we are halfway on the way to becoming a developed, advanced country. So we cannot use the same poverty indices as the really poor countries do. We have to move towards more advanced countries kinds of definitions of poverty.
Who would you say are our peers in that respect, the people that we should be paying closer attention to?
I think the countries in Latin America, for example, they have the same per capita income as we do. The countries in East Asia, Korea, Taiwan, they do have a higher per capita, but we are more or less the same in the phase of development.
During the debate on the 2016 budget, you drew attention to poverty among Malaysians and raised the gross discrepancy between the official statistics on poverty, which Prime Minister and Finance Minister Dato' Sri Najib Razak cited as a 0.6% in 2014, and comparing that to the findings of a small survey that you conducted in your constituency. Who were the subjects of your survey and why did you carry it out?
Okay, the subjects were the people staying in the kampongs in the hinterland of Sungai Siput. And the reason why I carried it out, because, you know, a lot of them do come and ask me for aid in paying their water bills, in the sending the children to higher education, you know, and I wanted to see what is the extent of poverty among them, what's the real income levels.
How did you carry out the survey?
Well, we have contacts among a lot of people in the kampongs. So what we did was we went and met people in the kampung and sit them down, have a cup of coffee and discuss and say, okay, who stays in this house? Who stays in the next house? What work do they do? So we get them to walk through the whole kampung mentally. So sometimes there are two or three of them, we could sit together and spend maybe 2 hours and we can more or less go through every house in the kampung, maybe about 80 houses or 100 houses, and get an idea of what people are working as.
And by the end of it, what were your findings overall in terms of these households and the situation that they're living in?
Well, I mean, we found that 45% of the households had incomes, you know, household incomes of less than 1,002 a month. And another about 40% had between 1,002 and 2,000. And only about 15% of the households had an income of more than 2,000 a month. So to us, that was quite a big figure, you know, because I mean, though our poverty level is, poverty line is defined at about $800, you know. But even $1,005 isn't quite enough, even in rural Sungai Siput, to send your children to school. You got to forget about tuition, you know, the bus fare to school. The cost is still difficult, you know. So we could see why they had a problem, because so many of them, 45%, had less than $1,002. So actually they are poor. In my eyes, they are poor.
What about unemployment? Did you see a lot of it there?
Well, it is more underemployment. A lot of them will say kerja kampung, which means they get work 2 days, 3 days a week, you know, cleaning up a place, you know, spraying weedy side or helping repair a house. But it's only about 2 days or 3 days a week which they actually get work. So it's a lot of underemployment.
Why do you think that there remains a high incidence of poverty among the Malays despite four decades of targeted affirmative action, considering the area in which you conducted the survey and the families which you spoke to?
I don't think it's confined to Sungai Siput alone. And I think the problem actually is the what we call the free market, you know. In Malaysia, I mean, if a number of the people in Sungai Siput who I surveyed were able to get jobs in the factories, which are just nearby, then the pressure on the land will be less and people have more land to farm on and the problem will be much better. But the problem is in Malaysia we have 5.5 million foreign workers who are brought in because they are low-wage labour and the factories prefer to employ them. So that's the reason why a lot of these people are pushed back to the kampongs and they're struggling to find land and, you know, trying to find jobs.
Earlier, you made the very good point that, in your opinion, despite the fact that these are not people who are living below the technical poverty line in our country, you would consider them poor. And 1,200 ringgit is indeed very little to meet the requirements of, say, a family of four, especially if you have children of school-going age, even in a rural setting. In your opinion, what is a just wage in our modern day and age?
Wage or poverty line? Poverty line?
Well, I guess it's a bit of both, right? What would be a just wage to receive and what would be a reasonable level at which to put our poverty line?
I think I'll take the second question first. I think a reasonable level will have to go by where you're staying. You know, if you're staying in a kampong, you have your own house, then maybe 1,005 per month for a family will be just about enough. You know, it'll be tight, but it'll be enough. But urban, I think even 3,000 a month would be tough. You know, in KL, for example, with house rent, and it'll be very, very, very tough in KL. So 3,000, perhaps, not the 800 that we're going by. As for wages, I think what is just and what is possible for Malaysia are two different things. You know, I think what will be just will be to, you know, if people can, a family can earn 3,000, means a wage of at least 1,005 per person. You know, but we also have to consider, would that affect jobs? If we price our wages too high, then our oil palm, for example, would not be competitive with Indonesia's oil palm, you know? And even our manufacturing sector may suffer. So there is a problem with that.
I think 800, you know, the reason why the poverty line is where it is in no small part because you sometimes just need a round figure. You don't want to have to shift the poverty line as you move across the country, as you move across different settings. But how important is it to be able to move that figure or definition of poverty for it to not just be one static figure across the board?
I think it's important, you know, because for example, you know, when you go for welfare, we have single mothers. I mean, they go for claiming welfare. If one of the, let's say a single mother's got a job in a factory and is earning 900, you know, per month minimum wage, welfare won't consider her because anything above 800 is considered non-poor, you know. But a mother with 900 with three kids, single mother, difficult to manage. But welfare, because of definition, then welfare doesn't give her. Because so I think it's important to change these definitions.
How would that work in a systemic setting? You know, once you start to change those settings, you know, to accommodate, as you say, these different situations.
Localities, yeah.
Yeah, how would that work?
I think basically it'll mean you've got to give out more welfare aid, you know, it's probably got to increase the welfare budget, you know, because the same budget, you know, I won't blame the welfare officers because they've got a certain allocation and they've got to give it to the poorest. And so they use certain cutoff points, you know. So if you raise the cutoff point, obviously you've got to give them more money.
And you would have more money to give in the first place.
Would you have?
Well, that's the hope.
Yes.
How can we depoliticize poverty measurement in order to really look at the reality of it on the ground in our country?
I think we've got to de-ethnicize politics. You know, if each group is talking about poverty among its own members and trying to deny poverty in others, you know, it becomes a zero-sum game. But I think we should move to a situation where we should be concerned about poverty of all Malaysians, whoever they are, whether they're Malays or they're Indians or they're Orang Asli or East Malaysians. We should be concerned, you know. And it's not an issue of saying if I'm talking about Malay poverty that I care less about Indian poverty or care less about Orang Asli poverty. I think we should talk about poverty of all the different groups and try and handle it. So I think it's the ethnic identification that makes it it makes it politicized.
You made reference to welfare just then, and in terms especially of how it's how it's given out, how you need to have those cutoff points. But in general, what are your thoughts on welfare handouts?
Well, you see, I'll have a question whether you want to call them handouts in the first place, you know. I see in Malaysia, we have a low-wage regime. And I think we're kind of tied into that because we're competing with Thailand and Vietnam and China for FDI and for markets overseas. So we cannot raise our wages too high. So if we are giving low wages to the bottom 40% of our population for national good, then we should consider different mechanisms where we can give them what I'll call a social wage. They get subsidized health, for example. They get subsidized housing. And those are not handouts. That's part of the social contract because they are sacrificing in terms of a low wage. So society should compensate them by, you know, subsidized basic needs.
I'm speaking today with Sungai Siput Member of Parliament, Dr. Jayakumar Devaraj, about addressing rural Malay poverty, although our conversation is ranging away from, I guess, as we pointed out, you know, making it an ethnic issue as such. Up next, we talk about what the 11th Malaysia Plan might have in store. You are listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
You're still here. Good. Now, if you're listening to this podcast while on the treadmill, you're already off to a good start. If you're not, don't forget to join us at BFM's Health and Living Live 2016 on the 2nd of April. Find out how you can live a better, healthier life. Go on and register at bfm.my/health.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and in the studio with me today, Sungai Siput Member of Parliament, Dr. Jayakumar Devaraj, who recently surveyed 130 low-income Malay families in his constituency and is talking about his findings. Now, according to the 11th Malaysia Plan report, upskilling and providing job opportunities to the 2.7 million bottom 40 households will reduce inequality passed on to future generations. In your view, is this sufficient?
No, I don't think it is. Because the issue now is not the lack of skills that leads to their being unemployed. It is because foreign workers are cheaper. I mean, one very simple thing is, let's say you take a Malaysian worker and pay him $900, the minimum wage, you also got to pay 13% as EPF. Whereas for the foreign worker, there's no EPF. There is a levy, but the employers cut it from the wages. So, you know, it's already cheaper then. So basically, there are economic disincentives to actually employing Malaysians. So how much you upskill, and basically these jobs don't require very much skill. So they're missing the point. It's not a lack of skill. It is because employers prefer foreign workers. They're cheaper.
And from that perspective, has migrant labour in Malaysia also contributed towards weakening the bargaining power of our local workers? Because as you say, you know, if you're cheaper, well, that's just always going to be the easier option.
Definitely so. But I wouldn't blame the migrant workers, you know. It's a system that allows that, you know. I mean, migrant workers also are bullied. A lot of migrant workers who work 12 hours for the basic wage, they don't get 4 hours overtime. And because they are migrant workers and they are fairly disempowered, they don't complain. Whereas a Malaysian worker will make noise and go to the labour department and insist he gets overtime, you know. So a lot of employers prefer migrant workers.
So if we were going to try and fix the system, where would you start?
First, you've got to start by acknowledging that we have a serious problem of underemployment for the B40. We can't say our unemployment figures are only 0.5% of the workforce, you know, because the people in the kampung who are not getting a proper job are not going and identifying themselves to the labour department. So your statistics are off. You've got to accept that first. And the second point is you've got to accept the fact that it's because migrant workers can be so easily bullied that leads to our workers also being affected adversely. So you've got to look into things to how can we prevent the bullying of migrant workers? How do we get them a right to redress, for example?
Another cause of poverty, or rural Malay poverty in particular, that you identified is the persistence of a feudal culture. Could you explain this? What led you to draw on this conclusion?
Well, I think it's basically because, there's a lot of government programs. In every budget, we allocate about 10 to 15 billion to help the rural poor. It comes to the agricultural department, subsidies. It comes to the RISDA, you know. But the thing is, a lot of these subsidies actually don't reach their targets. And the officers who are supposed to give out the subsidies and sometimes the politicians actually get the benefits, you know. And you see a situation where you have all these rural poor, you know, kissing the hands of the politicians who are actually taking their money, you know. So I find that very, you know, very odd, you know, and in some ways funny but sad as well, because it's this feudal culture, you know. So when your allocations are obscure, there's no transparency, the people will feel very grateful for the YB for giving $20,000 to repair the surau, not knowing that maybe the allocation was 40,000 and only 20,000 actually goes to them, you know. So that is the kind of problem. And they won't think of asking because, you know, this is element of huge amount of respect.
Let's talk about wages and how this affects things. Do we need to recognize to some extent that arguments for market forces, you know, determining wages and productivity gains to be the rationale for wage increases, that these arguments might have certain limitations?
Yes, they do. I think if you allow it to the free market, you know, they'll push on wages as low as they can go, you know. And in this case, they've done that by bringing in foreign workers. See, like now, we have a minimum wage of 900. But in Sungai Siput, I think actually it goes down to 600. Because we have, you know, out of the 5.5 million foreign workers, about 3 million are undocumented. And so they can't go and complain. If you pay them less than 900, they can't go and say, you know, this guy is paying me less because they are illegal. And so when a small contractor in the rural area, you know, a small farmer who needs labor to do certain things can get a foreigner for $600, he's not going to pay $900 for a Malaysian.
So how should we kind of try and remove these existing economic disincentives towards hiring Malaysian workers? You know, how realistic is it, especially when we're operating in a free market where people really are looking at profit? You know, ideally, we'd like to say, let's all be ethical, let's all do the right thing by everybody who's contributing towards the success of our business. But the truth is, well, if I pay you more, in some ways, you are eating in to what I perceive
as my profits.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. But the thing is that then condemns the bottom 40%, you know, to poverty. You see, the thing is, we've got to see who actually benefits from this whole low-wage policy. And one of the biggest beneficiaries are the companies who are linked to the people in power who are bringing in the thousands and thousands of foreign workers. They earn commissions, huge amount of commissions from this whole market. So it's actually, if you look at it ethnically, it is the rich Malay elite or some of them who are benefiting enormously from this by doing nothing really, and it's the Malay poor who are paying the price of low wages and underemployment. So we've got to address that. We've got to address that and expose the people who are creating the problem. And I think what we've got to do is we've got to make sure if we need foreign workers, we should treat them decently, because if we treat them poorly, it impacts adversely on our poor people as well.
You've said that we need to get tough on employers who employ immigrants without documents. Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Because when they do that, usually they pay below the minimum wage. Usually they do not pay overtime properly. And they do that, our own workers don't get a job. So I think, you know, the first step towards helping the B40 would be to make sure that the foreign workers are not bullied to this extent. It's self-preservation.
You've also made the argument that refugees should be recognized and registered and allowed to work legally. What would change if this did happen?
Well, nothing much really, because refugees only are about 100,000. Compared to the 5.5 million foreign workers we have, it's a very small, it's more a humanitarian thing, because a lot of refugees don't have documents. I mean, they ran for their lives, so where could they go and get a visa and all that? So, but in Malaysia, the problem is you don't recognize refugees as refugees. They're linked together with what we call the PATI, you know, Pendatang Asing Tanpa Izin. So now if I'm saying we're going to be tough on that, then they won't get jobs. So I think we should recognize refugees as refugees and give them a right to work.
Coming back to what's happening on the ground and with people who are local, you also go on to mention that rubber smallholders should be encouraged and helped to diversify fruit cultivation, animal husbandry. What is the rationale behind that suggestion?
Well, you see, we have about 400,000 rubber smallholders in this country, and most of them have small plots of land, you know, 2-3 acres. And they're really being affected by the low price of rubber on the world market. And I don't think it's going to go up very much, partly because, you know, Vietnam is producing, Indonesia is producing, Thailand is producing. We are, I think, about the fourth now. You know, so it's going to be difficult to control the market. And at the same time, if you're looking at the ecological problems, if you're going to cut down on private, you know, motor cars the world over, then your demand for rubber to make tires is going to go down. So I think it's going to kind of not a very... It's not a market that we should grow too fast anyway. It's not good for the climate to have more cars, you know. So I think we've got to see how these farmers, some of them, can diversify out of rubber.
Would fruit cultivation and animal husbandry contribute in, you know, in a very impactful way to their income?
It would, but it requires a market, you know. I mean, it depends on the market power of the Malaysian public. You know, if Malaysian public... have more wages, you know, have a higher income, they would buy more fruits. So I think it's linked there, you know. If you can increase the minimum wage, for example, it'll increase the market for people selling fruits.
You gave an example earlier of this, and another major point that you outlined is that rural society needs to be empowered in order to play a role in monitoring how the allocations meant for them are going to be utilized. If we were to take the example of Sungai Siput or, you know, another rural area, how would this be done exactly by the community?
Okay. You see, now, throughout the country, in Malay kampongs, the Ketua Kampong is actually nominated by the powers that be, you know, the local UMNO divisional head, you know, or the YB. He decides who is the Ketua Kampong together with the land office. And then the Ketua Kampong is paid a monthly allowance of about a few $100s. You know, I think it's $600 or $800. But the problem is when you are nominated by the ADUN and the DO, you're hardly in a position to question them. You know, how much money did we actually get for this project? You know, what was the allocation? What were the specifications of this project? Why are we giving it to a company that's linked to you? Or, you know, they can't ask those kind of questions because they are dependent on those guys who are actually they need to question. So they ought to play the role of check and balance. They must be selected by the people of the kampong in an election, and the allowance can be paid, but the selection and the removal of this Ketua Kampong should be completely left to the people. So that'll create an interesting, effective check and balance mechanism. Because I would say, I think in most rural areas, maybe 30%, 40% of the allocation meant for the local community actually is diverted to other people. And if there's a check and balance, maybe that ratio can come down.
We've been talking about the poor for the entirety of the interview, but even within, of course, that group of people, there are going to be others who are more at risk, who are more, at risk of falling through social safety nets. How can we address the problem of poor social protection for the elderly in particular?
Well, what my party is talking about is that we should start a kind of a pension scheme for all old people, maybe kick in a bit later. I mean, it is actually going to be a costly thing. So we have estimated if we give each person over 70 years old a pension of $200 a month, it'll come to just below $2 billion per year at this point in time. So giving it to people who are not government pensioners, who are not getting SOCSO pension, ILAT, you know, for those. So it will be covering about maybe 75% of the population. That'll be a way of helping out these people.
What would that amount be able to do? You know, we've been talking about cost of living. We've been talking about how much you need to really make it. That figure, would it really help?
I think it'll help a lot. I mean, the thing is, they cannot live separately. I mean, like say, for example, in Australia, they do give a pension that's enough for them to rent a house and stay independently. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, like, you know, now the elderly person who's 70, 75 is staying with his son or daughter and no income at all. And actually, his costs of going to a hospital, you know, going to collect medicines, you know, buying his whatever he buys for himself, buying a teh tarik, he's still dependent on his son or his daughter. So a little bit of money like this would increase their independence and make them less of a burden to the family and make them probably more welcome in the home, you know. I think it'll do wonders for them. Though it won't allow them to live separately, but it'll make their lives more dignified.
It'll improve quality of life overall.
Definitely, definitely. Okay.
Your last suggestion is that we stop the privatization of public services such as healthcare, tertiary education, water supply, transport, etc. What can you weigh in on that? I mean, could you elaborate?
Okay, like for example, when we have more private hospitals, when you have health tourism, for example, what happens is government specialists go to the private sector. You have this brain drain. And when that happens, the quality of care in the government hospitals tends to go down. People are anxious. So I do see a lot of people in Sungai Siput who are not wealthy, but who still go to the private hospitals because they are afraid that if they go to the government, they may not get proper treatment. And of course, that care, the costs go up. So I think that's what we got to do because, coming back to the earlier point of a social wage, because we are stuck in a low-wage regime because of the global economic system. We can't give, let's say, okay, let's have a minimum wage of $2,000 a month. You know, we can't do that because if we do that, we're cutting our own necks in terms of jobs, in terms of our products being competitive in the world market. So because we are forced to keep our wages low, we should think of ways in which we can transfer the wealth of society, share it with the bottom 40%. And these kind of, you know, subsidized health services, for example, subsidized tertiary education, for example, these things would benefit, would be the way to go, I think, you know. So we have got a judicial mix of a reasonable minimum wage, but which still can't do justice. So you need to have a social wage. And a social wage means things like this pension, for example, for the old, you know, stuff like that.
Ultimately, what learnings can we take from the survey that was done and the efforts in terms of eradicating poverty among the Malays and the rural Malays in particular that we can successfully take on to address poverty in other groups, in other sectors?
I think the causes of why rural Malays can't get jobs and so much underemployment among them is the same reason why, you know, Indian youth, for example, in urban areas also can't get jobs for the same reason. So the causes of poverty affects all ethnic groups. So we're focusing on Malay kampongs. The same problem affects, say, you know, urban dwellers in KL, for example, in the high-rise flats. A lot of the young youth, whatever race they are, have problems getting jobs for the same reason, because employers prefer foreigners. You know, and then when things get privatized and the cost of education goes up, the cost of housing goes up, it affects everyone, not only the B40, you know. I think housing affects the B80, the bottom 80%. All of us affected. So I think we got to look at these things. You know, the things which you have identified are specific to the Malay poor. They affect all of us.
How as members of community, can we not distance ourselves from this? Because I think when you're not in the B40, it gets very easy to continue living in this system because it doesn't affect you. And in some ways, you might feel like, well, it works because it benefits me and my life is fine. So what kind of message would you offer for people who feel this is not really my problem? And what can we do to make it our problem?
Well, I guess making contact with the poorer communities is probably the best way of opening your eyes. If you're interested in doing that, then there are a lot of poor communities all over the country. Even in KL, the groups want to go and see, for example, the soup kitchens, you know, food for the street people, or starting a tuition project in a low-cost flats. That will open one's eyes to what's happening. And I think ultimately, if you want to build a better society, we've got to be concerned about each other. If we happen to be well off, if we are lucky to get an education, we're from a family which will give us that, then we should be concerned about the people who didn't get that. And only then can you build a harmonious society.
I've been speaking today with Dr. Jayakumar Devaraj, MP for Sungai Siput, and we've been discussing addressing rural Malay poverty and poverty as a whole. You've been listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.